This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
This is the Dying to Know podcast series. If you're dying to know, we're dying to tell.
Dr. Jessica Zitter practices the unusual combination of critical and palliative care medicine at Highland Hospital in Oakland, California. She attended Stanford University and Case Western Reserve University Medical School and earned her master's in public health from the University of California, Berkeley. Her medical training includes an internal medicine residency at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and a fellowship in pulmonary critical care at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also co-founder of Vital Decisions, a telephone-based counselling service for patients with life-limiting illness, as well as the author of a new book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, published in February this year. Jessica, thank you for joining me on the line from Oakland, California.
Very happy to be here.
There is so much to explore in your new book, Extreme Measures, a book that I couldn't put down over the weekend. And I'd like to begin with a few questions about the book before we then move on to DeathEd, a fantastic initiative that first brought you to my attention last year. In the book, Jessica, you talk about patient-centered care. Can you explain what this is and why it is so important?
Patient-centered care is so much what it sounds like. It's about putting the patient at the center of the care. And I know it sounds so obvious, and why wouldn't anybody ever do that? But the reality is that over the past several decades, many decades, probably verging on 100 years, we have been putting our focus on technology. As technology started out, you know, in the late 30s and 40s of the iron lung to, you know, that we obviously know saved so many people from the polio epidemic, we've seen it as this great savior, this sort of miracle cure, and we've developed our entire medical institution around it, creating more and more super specialties with more and more technology and hyper-targeted drugs and therapies, and we've actually started to focus so much on the physiology, on the organ, on the disease, that we've really lost sight of the patient. So this movement is about putting the patient and the patient's need back at the center of the healthcare plan.
Jessica, would you like to talk a little bit about your journey that led you from being a critical care doctor into a palliative care doctor?
Yes, I would love to. It's something that was pretty jarring and unexpected for me. It started out, I come from a family of doctors, pretty intensive doctors, a lot of surgeons and emergency room doctors. And, you know, medicine was sort of it was a family business. And I really was regaled by stories of, you know, 11th hour saves and super specialized surgeries. And my father's a neurosurgeon. And there was always some interesting story and something very heroic that I was hearing about. And I went into medicine. I went into critical care medicine because that was the subspecialty that seemed to me to be one of the most heroic, in the medical subspecialties. And I went in really excited about learning about physiology and about learning how to fix physiology with machines and treatments and medications. It was really exciting, sort of the idea that you could take somebody and rescue them from the jaws of death. And so I really went into my medical training with this excitement and enthusiasm, and was really, over the first few years of my training, now looking back, confronted by a lot of moral distress, rising moral distress in myself. I didn't have a word for it. I didn't have a name for it. All I knew was the type of approach to caring for patients that I was being taught, which was technology-oriented and physiology-oriented. But I knew that somehow, on some subconscious level, I was causing a lot more suffering to my patients than I was intending, than I had gone in intending to. And it was very painful, because when you're doing something and you don't really know another alternative path, and you know that the thing that you're doing is causing pain, you sort of build up defenses, psychological defenses, to cope with it. I would say that I kind of started having this, walking this path of moral distress where I felt bad and uncomfortable, and then with veer over onto the other edge of the path, which was sort of, again, go and super celebrate these technologies. And it was very uncomfortable. And then by total chance, in my early attendingship, you know, the after I had done my first several years of training, and I was a new attending at a hospital in Newark, New Jersey, it was very, very coincidental that this particular small hospital had won one of four very sought-after grants by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to enhance communication in the intensive care unit. It was really the beginning of the palliative care movement. It didn't yet have a name in the United States. This was 2003 that this grant was won by this hospital that I started working at. All of a sudden, there was this quote-unquote, you know, family support team in the intensive care unit. They would become the palliative care team many years later once that became an official subspecialty. But at this time, they were called the family support team. And it was run by a nurse, Pat Murphy, who had been trained in palliative care principles. She'd actually spent some time with some of the hospices. But, you know, again, very early early person to this subspecialty. And she would come in to the intensive care unit and be very, in some ways, I'd say, critical of the treatment that I was doing. She would, you know, criticize my lack of communication with the patients, that I hadn't clarified their poor prognosis, that I wasn't attending to their pain and symptoms well enough. You know, some of the things that we know now as are part of the palliative care movement, enhanced communication and symptom management. And I at first brushed her off and found her to be honestly annoying and maybe touchy-feely. But then, you know, one day I had an epiphany moment with her where she actually came in and was watching me as I was putting in a catheter into a patient who was not going to survive the night. And honestly, I knew it and everyone knew it, but it was just part of this protocol of going, you know, continuing on with the technology. And she pretended to call. She put her hand up to her ear and said, 911, get me the police. They're torturing a patient in the ICU. It was a moment of shock and just, I would say, devastation for me. I was horrified and hurt and scared and traumatized. And it was the culmination of a lot of, again, these years of moral distress that I had been experiencing. And so, to make a long story short, Pat then became my mentor and really started to teach me about the principles of palliative care.
So moving into palliative care, as a palliative care doctor, how difficult is it not to project your own values onto a patient, especially if your initial training has been in critical care?
And it's funny. We have this phrase called see one, do one, teach one in medicine and, you know, the technology subspecialties. You see one, see somebody do a Quinton catheter, you do one yourself, and then you can teach when you're an expert. And I will say, in some ways, that is a paradigm that fits with palliative care as well and patient-centered care. If you learn about patient-centered care from somebody, if you start to understand that you haven't been administering patient-centered care, and then you start to learn some of the principles of it, in some ways, you can't really go back. You see one, and then you must do one, and then you become a teacher of it and a disciple of the movement yourself. Because I think, you know, it's just, in a way, I'd say it's just kind of a common sense approach. It's an approach that I think is filled with justice. I think that doctors who are going that route of the old heroism know on some level that when we're doing things to patients, that it's not that there's any malintent per se, but that lack of disclosure, the lack of conversation, of the breaking of bad news is in itself, I think, a form of injustice that we kind of carry with us and know about. And I think once you've done it a different way, it's very hard to go back.
So, Jessica, I know in the book that you talk about a good death, and to a lot of people that sounds like a bit of an oxymoron, but what is a good death?
A good death? Good is a relative term. Honestly, I don't mean it to say, I don't mean it in the sense that, oh, death can be good and death can be pleasurable. I've witnessed a lot of, I mean, death is hard even in the best of circumstances in many cases. Sometimes it can be comfortable. But for me, a good death is two things. One, it's not filled with unnecessary suffering. It's not added to. The burden of dying, which sometimes exists just in a natural state, is not added to by unnecessary suffering from what we call iatrogenic suffering, or the suffering that's caused by doctors and the healthcare system. So that's one thing, though. It's not worsened by our healthcare system. And the second thing is that it is driven primarily by what the patient wants. And again, that could be anything. They, you know, everybody's different. Everybody has his or her own preferences and values. And so what's right for one person may not be right for another. What's a good death for one person may be a terrible death for another. It's very personal. So that's really the point of a good death. It's both as little suffering as is possible and certainly not worsened by the healthcare system. And number two, it is as driven by the patient's own personal preferences and values as possible.
In the early 2000s, along with business partner Helen Blank, you established Vital Decisions, which was your first startup website about advanced care planning. I know that this has been hugely successful, but I was wondering when I was reading about that in your book, how many medical professionals do you know that have documented advanced care wishes?
A great question. You know, the first thing I'll say is I'm embarrassed to tell you that I haven't really spoken to many of my colleagues and friends about that, which is a little embarrassing to admit, honestly. I don't know the answer to that question. I would imagine if they're anything like me, that it's not as high a number as it should be, as I would hope it would be.
Well, I wonder then, do doctors and nurses die differently from their patients?
Well, that's a very important topic of discussion for a number of reasons. Number one, it certainly seems they would. Based on my anecdotal experience, most of my colleagues and friends and the nurses and all the people that I work with, you know, who know about what it can look like, going to be more vigilant and, from my experience, are less likely to choose these types of, it's not a question of choosing, but to end up on this, what I call end-of-life conveyor belt. You know, the end-of-life conveyor belt, let me just define, is this concept, this relentless, automatic application of increasing amounts of technology to dying bodies without any discussion. And I think, you know, people who know what that looks like, you know, certainly people who work in the intensive care unit, but doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals in general wouldn't choose that. It's the grisly nature of what can happen on the end-of-life conveyor belt is what motivated me, made me realize that I couldn't continue to just blindly administer that anymore.
There's a wonderful story in your book about the ICU nurse and her tattoo. Perhaps you'd like to share that.
One day, about 5 or 6 years ago, I was at a conference called Mindfulness in the Intensive Care Unit. One of the things that does not that is not a part of patient-centered care for the most part is mindfulness. So we don't tend to be contemplative and thoughtful and to process things in medicine. We just tend to act. And so this idea of mindfulness and really trying to be mindful in a place like the intensive care unit really kind of caught my eye. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Let me go to this. And I went to this conference at UCSF. The person running it was a man named Mitchell Levy, who's a very, very well-known ICU doctor here in America, who has actually been one of the people who's worked on the sepsis bundle and managing sepsis, but he also happens to be a Buddhist. He is also, in addition to solving the problem of sepsis, very interested in the idea that we should be more mindful as caregivers in an intensive care unit. And so he had this talk about that was geared towards healthcare providers. Most of the people there were nurses, not doctors. And one of the nurses at lunch said, well, you know, they're not getting me. I got this tattoo. And I looked at her and said, what do you mean? And she kind of pulled her shirt aside and she showed me this tattoo on her chest over her heart that said, no code. You know, I had heard many, many people jokingly talk about tattooing, you know, do not resuscitate on their chest. I'd never seen anybody actually do it, but this woman had done it.
Jessica, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about an initiative that you started last year. Well, it came to my attention last year through the Open IDO Challenge on Reimagining End of Life. And it was a program called Death Ed. And then I read about Death Ed in the New York Times Sunday Review in February this year. And the article that you wrote for the New York Times started out, 5 years ago, I taught sex education at my daughter Tessa's class. Last week, I taught death education at my daughter Sasha's class. Why should death be considered more taboo than sex? Both are a natural part of life. Why do you think we are so afraid to talk about death, and especially with our children?
Well, part of the reason I was late for this interview is because we were doing, we were teaching some of the kids from the Oakland public schools today here at our hospital, a death education class. I think we like sex. I mean, I really do think that they're the same. It's the same paradigm, actually, that we think that these taboos, they're taboo subjects because we get uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable, you know, sex for the reason that we don't like the talk about intimacy. We don't like to, you know, we were puritanical. Who knows exactly what the reason is, but we don't like to talk about sex in our society. But I think death, for slightly different reasons, is not this discomfort with the act, but it's this idea of this fantasy of perpetual life that we have as humans, that we want to survive, and particularly now that we have these distractions that we can look at as some kind of a miracle cure and something to allow distract us from the realities of death, which already is an uncomfortable concept for a human genome. We're trying to survive. We're it's evolutionary to want to stay alive. And so for these slightly separate but actually very similar reasons, these are two topics that we just feel uncomfortable talking about, and we don't want to, we don't want to share them with our children. Sex because it's embarrassing, and death because we're afraid and we're sad, and it brings up this confrontation with our existence, and that's very, very painful to do. But the problem is that the result of not talking about these very important fundamental subjects that are a part of every human being's life, or most of us, but certainly death, everybody, is that we end up depriving our population of basic knowledge, sort of about how to conduct our lives and live as healthy a life as we can all the way to the very end. We deprive our children of this, we deprive the rest of our population, and we end up with the results that we have now, which is very serious public health crisis, bad dying.
Can you perhaps explain the modules that you've put together for the high school health curriculum that you've piloted and the course that you're perhaps teaching today? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. My friend Dawn Gross, who's another palliative care physician, and I submitted this proposal to the Open IDEO Challenge. I had actually already been thinking about it as a topic and had written this article for the New York Times beforehand. And when this opportunity came up for us to apply, it seemed like a really great opportunity, and obviously resonated with the rest of the community because it did well in this challenge. And we've sort of taught it a couple of different ways. Once we won a top idea designation in the challenge, oh no, now we really need to do something. There was no curriculum written up. We threw together something, and we only had 2 hours. You know, this was my child's school. She goes to a very progressive school. And I just called them and said, off the cuff, is there any chance you'd be willing to let us pilot this? We just won this designation at Open IDEO. And to my very strong surprise, they said, sure, come on in. I was very surprised. I thought they would find it too taboo.
Yeah, I wondered how you pitched that death egg program to your daughter's school. I really wondered how, what their initial response from school leadership was.
Yeah. I was shocked. I have to be honest. In fact, I know, that the administrators, because my kids have been there for a few years, but I've said to them several times since, wow, you guys are brave. And that was brave.
Yeah.
They didn't know how it was going to go. They didn't know if any parents were going to get angry. They didn't know if any kids were going to run out of the room crying. And, it was brave of them to let us do it. We ended up doing it that first time. We had two hours. And truly, 2 hours to talk about death education is a micro dot of time. When you think about all the things that you want in terms of the literacy of death education, it's a lot of things that you want to explain to people. So I, being an ICU doctor and, thinking a lot about this end-of-life conveyor belt as these, mechanized dying and how many people die, very highly mechanized deaths in America. I'm not sure what it's like in Australia, but it's a very serious problem here in America. And I thought, well, let's pick the lowest hanging fruit and let's talk about the end-of-life conveyor belt with these kids. Let's talk to them about the machines that get applied in an intensive care unit and how that can constitute the end-of-life conveyor belt and how that, how important it is to understand sort of what you're getting into and use it wisely. I mean, technology is wonderful. I mean, I'm all for saving lives and using technology. But in the context of serious illness, It's a different matter, and for some people would be unacceptable to use or to use for any prolonged period of time. So trying to explain that concept was sort of what we focused on. And we, again, spent the first hour introducing that idea of what an ICU is and what you can expect from ICUs, and then kind of slowly and gently introducing this idea of an end-of-life conveyor belt. And we showed a clip from Grey's Anatomy. I don't know if you have seen Grey's Anatomy.
Yep.
You have it in Australia.
Yeah.
You do?
Yes, we do.
Well, you know, so then you know that there are many sort of unrealistic, kind of, honestly, I'd venture to say silly, examples of the use of technology in a heroic way that's totally unrealistic. And so we took a short clip and actually compiled a couple of things into a short clip to show this quite funny sequence of events that happened on a Grey's Anatomy episode, and then told the kids, look, this isn't real. It's not real. And then we went on to show the 2-minute, 90-second trailer of Extremis, the movie that I don't know if, I'm not sure if you can see it in Australia, but it's on Netflix, intensive care unit. And we then sort of explained that that is actually much more realistic, and that clip shows people on breathing machines who are unable to speak and unable to talk, and kind of gives a sense of some of the difficult decisions that need to be made apropos of these machines, that it's not just this one-and-done quick fix, oh, everything's okay now, but that there's grueling and wrenching decisions that need to be made a lot of the time. The second hour, we taught them how to play this game called Go Wish. And it's if you want to go look up gowish.org, it's this pack of cards that is 36 cards, each one with a preference, something that's important to you. You know, being kept clean, not being in pain, having my affairs in order, et cetera. And we taught the kids how to play this game. The game ultimately is about identifying your own personal preferences and values and then describing them in more detail, kind of, you know, building them out and understanding them and sharing them with your family. And so that's how we did it the first couple of times. And then we got some feedback that the first hour was a little bit boring and dry. And so we ended up switching it out and showing this movie, Extremis, to the kids. I was terrified. It was my friend's suggestion that we actually bring the movie. And I thought, oh, gosh, these are ninth graders. This feels, it's going to be too hard for them. But then I realized, you know, my kids saw this movie when they were, you know, teenagers and close to ninth grade, and they did fine. And all of my friends' children saw the movie as well, and no one freaked out. And I thought, you know, why not try it and see how these kids do? So we showed, the third time we took the class, we showed the movie Extremis for the first hour, and then we kind of debriefed about it, and then we did the Go Wish game the second hour.
Jessica,
and that's how we've been doing it.
I'm wondering, are there any studies that show how much understanding of death a child has at different ages? I know your program was for high school students, and you're talking about year nine in particular, but what age should we start talking to our children about death, and where do we go to find guidance on language? And obviously, you've talked about Go Wish, which sounds like a fantastic tool, but are there other tools that parents can source?
You know, I'll tell you the honest truth. When we were writing this up for the Open IDEO Challenge, I looked at some of the data on death education, and there was almost none. There was one class that I found for high school students in a school up in upstate New York that was a year-long curriculum run by a guy who was just interested in death. So he kind of took it upon himself to teach this class. But there were no, as far as I could find, there were no death classes for high school students. There was a lot of debate online about whether or not you should talk to kids about death, and much of it coming honestly from the conservative right saying no because you're going to cause suicide. And there's no evidence that I could find of any link between talking about death or death education and suicide. And so there was, you know, little bits here and there of stuff, but there's really not a lot of data out there about this topic. And, you know, I think that it's time for us to start looking at it. We've, you know, at this point, I'd say now, so in addition to these three classes that I taught in high schools, I've been teaching also some high school student groups who come into our hospital, local children from the local high schools who are interested in learning about healthcare, you know, professions. It's also been a very interesting experience. There've been, you know, different issues get triggered for different groups. I would say that it's been a positive experience. Just today, when I was teaching these high school students, we watched the movie, and then we stood up to talk about issues from the movie. And one of the things that I was just so struck by the sophistication of these kids when I said, you know, tell me what you think about. Do you think doctors are good at telling patients and families about their prognosis? I had to explain what prognosis meant. And a few hands kind of went up and said, yeah, I think doctors are good at it. And I said to them, actually, let me tell you, the data do not actually show that. The data show that doctors are actually pretty poor at telling patients and families about what they think is going to happen. And so we went through, you know, why do you think that might be? And these kids were so astute, and they said, well, what about uncertainty? You know, which is a big thing that I like to talk about, that you know, we hide in a way behind uncertainty and say, well, I'm not 100% sure, so I'm not going to tell you what I think. But, you know, these students agreed, well, that's not really fair, because then you don't let people prepare for their own death. They also correctly identified that another reason doctors might not want to tell the truth is because they're afraid of not being liked. And I, again, pulled up some data and told them that it's true. You know, doctors aren't as well liked if they give bad news as when they give good news. And that's a definite demotivator for telling people bad news. And so they were very engaged, and they understood a lot of the issues. And I believe that just from a healthcare literacy perspective, if a kid hears this kind of information from a doctor, for example, saying, actually, we're not doing a good job telling you the truth, they may be more likely in the future to go and ask for the truth or demand the truth from the healthcare team when they have a sick loved one in the hospital. And I think that's the way we spread this kind of literacy and this kind of true death and dying education, and hopefully will change the way things are being done.
It sounds like you have your work certainly cut out for you with death education. But in looking at your forthcoming events, the Final Acts Project Conference, the Endwell Symposium, there seems to be more opportunity to talk about death in a professional environment. Do you think that we are getting better at talking about death and dying?
Yes, I think that we are getting better at talking about it in many circles. I mean, I don't think in every circle, but in many circles in society, it's becoming more accepted. You know, there's, again, I don't know what's happening in Australia, but here in America, we're having death cafes and death over dinner and the rise of the palliative care movement. And, you know, there is more literacy about it in the general lay public. And we certainly have within the medical culture, we have the rise of the palliative care movement, which is making inroads. So I think there's more talking about it. We're getting better at talking about it, but we still have a ways to go in terms of actually changing behaviors. It's one thing to talk about it when you are in a sort of calm state of mind, but it's another thing to change the way we're doing things when there's emotion, when there's fear, when there's illness, when there's acute decompensation of physiology. We're not necessarily at a point yet where I think we're starting to consistently be able to hold ourselves firm and calm and really stay patient-centered and not fall into these patterns of wishful thinking for miracle cures when those kinds of things are starting to happen, if that makes sense to you.
No, it does make perfect sense to me. Dr. Jessica Zitter, thank you for giving your time so generously today. It's been such a privilege speaking with you.
Oh, pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much.
Selena, can you squeeze my hand?
Here's the reality. We're all going to die. Everyone standing in this room is going to die one day. And it's good to have a little bit of a say in how.
I want to make sure that she knows that we've explored all the options.
Every day, people are attached permanently to machines. My concern is we're going to cause more suffering without likely benefit.
The other approach is let her pass naturally.
It would feel like murder to pull her life support.
If I had to make the decision for myself, then take me off, and if I breathe on my own, then that's fine. That's God's will.
Amen.
How would you feel if you were not getting better on a breathing machine?
Then I don't want to be on a breathing machine.
It's his decision, but I don't want to see him go.
We're going to support you through this.
Put the crash card in.
She won't wake up from this in a meaningful way.
Mama?
Knowing at some point you got to get to that reality, and now it's here.
You've been listening to Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au. a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.